Welcome to Cats Cast, a bi-weekly podcast delivering interviews, arts, culture, and history from New York's Catskill Mountains. This week, a chapter from the new audiobook edition of The Quarry Fox and Other Critters of the Wild Catskills, written and narrated by Leslie T. Sharp. From crafty foxes and hibernating bears to vulnerable monarch butterflies, The Quarry Fox explores the creatures of the Great Western Catskills in loving, lyrical detail. Heir to John Burroughs, who tramped through these mountains more than 100 years before her, Sharp revisits the meadows, creeks, and bobcat dens, and invites us to come along for the trek. Following is chapter 4 from the book, titled Natural Beauties. You can hear The Quarry Fox wherever audiobooks are sold or request it from your local library. Thank you to our sponsor, the Central Catskills Chamber of Commerce, providing services to businesses, community organizations, and local governments in the Central Catskills region. Follow the Central Catskills Chamber of Commerce on Facebook and sign up for a weekly email of local events at centralcatskills.com. And now, from The Quarry Fox and Other Critters of the Wild Catskills, the chapter Natural Beauties, narrated by the author, Leslie T. Sharp.
Chapter 4, Natural Beauties, for Lauren Isley.
Finally, it was warm, an evening in early June. The fireflies had begun to rise in the meadows, twinkling in the high grass, signaling their desire. I could hear through the window, opened at last after a chilly spring, the plunking of green frogs at the pond, and though their chorus had diminished as summer approached, the insistent whistling of spring peepers, stalwart suitors reluctant to cease their courtship song. The night air was redolent with the sweet, delicate fragrance of wild rose. My thorny adversary, tough and recalcitrant, suddenly turned ethereal, its white blossoms covering the mountain like a spring snowstorm, gentling even the harsh, stony Catskills. Stepping outside shortly after midnight to answer the insistent calling of a barred owl, whoo-hoo-hoo-hoo, I noticed how moths were circling the security light, perched on a metal pole set several yards from the house. I had been advised when I first moved to the mountain to keep a light on at night to deter critters from climbing onto the back deck. The black bears had behaved, but porcupines especially had not been deterred, routinely gnawing on the wooden decking, causing several boards to be replaced. Opening the back door one morning, I had discovered a young porcupine small enough to curl up on the core mat where it had fallen asleep, which I gently rousted with a broom. I was mesmerized by the moths, swirling in the milky, vaporous light. At the edges of the luminous halo, dark shadows appeared, bats, nemesis of night-flying insects hunting prey. Suddenly they plunged into the light, scattering the moths, which, despite the onslaught, would not abandon the glowing circle. The bats were also drawn to the porch lights. On summer mornings, I often found shards of moths, fragments of wings mostly, on both decks. The bats, I quickly learned, would devour the moths' succulent body but leave behind their pesky appendages. The porch lights have their own ecosystem. The lights attract moths and in turn their predators, the spiders that spin their messy webs, waiting for the moths to alight, and the bats, which feast on the insects that assemble there. I felt no remorse for the moths, such drab insects, small and flitting, in barely distinguishable shades of brown and gray, many of them notorious pests, at least in their voracious, larval form, caterpillars. The night-flying adults mostly go unnoticed, and those that settle on screens on a summer night, seeking light, are usually ignored, except by cats, which know them as the fascinating creatures they are. Cats are the ideal naturalists, patient, persistent, ever watchful. Their powers of observation are unsurpassed. My own cats, a tricolored calico and a pearly gray, alert me to the comings and goings of critters, especially birds alighting on the deck rail. A gray Phoebe flycatcher twitching her tail, Young robins newly fledged sitting in a row, fuzzy and speckled, solemn after taking their first flight. The cats chatter their staccato hunting call, indignant at being ignored by their prey. There are other nosy visitors, gray squirrels, chipmunks, and white-footed mice, which tantalize the cats, coming so close, peering at them through the windows. The little red squirrel with its devilish ear tufts, brash and irreverent, seems to enjoy mocking them, racing up and down the front deck, leading the housebound felines on a futile chase. If a moth manages to slip in, they pursue it recklessly, leaping into the air, clattering over tables, knocking everything off until I manage to corral the hapless insect and escort it outside. The calico, who was also the clown, stubby and graceless though very sweet, often finds herself in need of rescuing from her misadventures. It wasn't the first time I would find her hanging by her claws from the screen door. When I came in that night, after watching the moths and bats dance their skittering minuet, usually she would cry, unable to extricate herself from the screen, a mournful keening that crescendos into a yowl. But this time, when I went to rescue her, she was chattering, her eyes fixed upward in that intense, narrow concentration so characteristic of cats, pointing at her prey. When I saw what she was stalking, I stepped back from the front door and gasped. The creature was huge, at least compared to the other moths clinging to the screen, lured by the porch light. It had two long tails and wide, arcing wings that spanned over 4 inches. But what captivated me was its color, the tender green of the spring forest, newly leafed, a green that had an odd luminosity, as if it glowed from within, like an egg tempera painting. I reached out to touch the creature through the screen. It fluttered off, disappearing into the darkness. Tinkerbell was my silly, thoroughly unscientific assessment. It was the first time I had ever seen a Luna moth. There are some creatures that are so beautiful they don't seem real. Their colors are so vibrant, their markings so crisp, they look painted. Birds especially, including Catskill summer residents, such as the wood duck, cedar waxwing, and many wood warblers, with their variegated and often spectacular plumage, have captivated artists from John James Audubon to Roger Torrey Peterson to the contemporary master David Allen Sibley, whose finely etched watercolor illustrations convey the delicacy and subtlety as well as the boldness and brightness of their avian subjects. But just as striking, if less well known and certainly underappreciated, are nature's other beauties, insects. Butterflies, of course, ever showy, get most of the kudos. They are first, eminently visible, flying by day, flashing their vivid colors, revealing often intricate patterning as they alight on flowers to suck nectar through their proboscis, a long, thin feeding tube that is coiled in flight. Their colorful wings catching the sun help hide them from predators, making them difficult to see among the blooms. Camouflage that, for us, is eye-catching. Their color may also enable them to identify and communicate with each other, helping butterflies to find a mate. In some species, a butterfly's color can signal danger. The monarch, as regal as its name, is colored orange and black, colors whose resonance of danger we have inherited in Halloween, a signal for predators such as birds to stay away. They taste awful, the result of the monarch laying its eggs on the noxious milkweed, and another species, the smaller viceroy, mimics the monarch's coloration, and though not bitter-tasting, benefits from its bad reputation. The monarch also has romance. Its extraordinary cycle of migration, a fall journey of as much as 3,000 miles, as monarchs in North America travel from as far away as Canada to roost in sites in California and Mexico, where they overwinter, and then return to breed the following spring. Even butterflies' names are stirring and magical. The monarch and its vassal viceroy, painted ladies and red admirals, swallowtails, tiger, spicebush, and the elegant, formerly attired black swallowtail, satyrs and clouded sulfurs, question marks, commas, and the mourning cloak, the great spangled fritillary, and the diminutive pearl crescent, which always seems to hatch after a Catskill thunderstorm, to name a common few of North America's approximately 750 species. Second only to the Coleoptera, better known as beetles, the largest order in the animal kingdom, 150,000 species of Lepidoptera, butterflies and moths, have been described or formally identified worldwide. Of these, only 20,000 are butterflies. The vast majority, some 130,000 species, is largely ignored, at least until they plague us, moths. To be sure, many moths deserve our opprobrium. We encounter them often as destructive insects, the larvae in caterpillar form, feeding on wool sweaters and devouring grain, miscreants known as clothes moths and pantry moths, respectively. Their rural cousins, forest tent caterpillars, can decimate the leaves of some of our most beautiful and economically important trees in the Catskills, notably sugar maple, oak, aspen, apple, alder, elm, cherry, and birch. But far more grievous is the destruction of habitat, for which nature has no remediation at human hands. Frequently, it is the butterfly, especially the monarch, which is the poster bug for this loss. Its host, specifically for its larval stage, the milkweed, an invasive though fragrant native species whose pinkish blooms are intoxicating in their sweetness, is rapidly disappearing in the dense stands the monarch needs to successfully rear succeeding generations. The monarch's beauty is an argument for its preservation. Its bright orange wings, boldly veined and bordered in black, are iconic, as is the monarch's immense journey, a marvel and mystery of nature, perhaps only equaled by the migration of the fragile hummingbird, weighing less than an ounce, which also braves a treacherous two-way trip, traveling from the Catskills and points even further north in fall to destinations as far south as Central America, then returning home to nest the following spring. "Don't there seem to be fewer butterflies this year?" is a refrain I often hear in the Catskills. Such anecdotal evidence may well be true, an indication of the impact of pesticides as well as shrinking wildflower fields on insect populations. But the point is that the butterfly, with its vivid colors, fluttering from flower to flower on a sunlit summer day, is readily missed, its loss lamented. Every schoolchild learns that butterflies are not just pretty, but also useful pollinators. So is the moth, which, like the butterfly, appeared on Earth tens of millions of years ago, with the advent of flowering plants. Yet this fellow Lepidoptera is mostly ignored and stigmatized for the sins of a relative few. And butterfly larvae, though not as notorious, are just as gluttonous as their moth brethren. Such is the prejudice of beauty, how it biases us, which I am the first to admit I share. It wasn't until my encounter with Actius luna, the luna moth, that I considered moths as anything more than prey, a favorite fare of bats and birds, spiders and praying mantises, amphibians such as frogs, toads, and salamanders, and the terrestrial mammals too. I often watch with clinical detachment as skunks plucked moths off of the lower part of the light pole where they had landed. The possum, shy and slow, would also visit, braving the brightness of the security light to scrounge a snack, as well as the clever raccoons, which scooped up their quarry with agile hands. That moths were so vulnerable didn't concern me until I glanced out the window later that night and spotted the luna clinging to the metal pole, keeping company with the smaller moths, which surrounded it like courtiers. The luna moth, a native species, is not considered rare in its North American range, though it is elusive. Flying after midnight, its lifespan barely a week, In the Catskills, I have observed only a single generation of Luna moths, emerging from their cocoons to fly in June when it is finally warm. If a Luna moth lands on your hand, that's good luck, one Catskill old-timer told me. Don't see him around too much here, though. I watched for a while, willing the Luna to fly off the pole as the bats shape-shifted ominously through the circle of light. It dismayed me that something so beautiful should be prey, even though I knew how ridiculous, how utterly irrelevant that notion was. Nature's beauty, if it acknowledged it, is in the adaptations it contrives for critters to survive and successfully reproduce. It plays no favorites. The dowdy moth, as commonly seen as the Luna is rarely sighted, is just as useful as pollinator and prey. Both, from nature's perspective, are far more utilitarian than I am, a human, less ecologically significant than a moth, and far less important than an earthworm, which admirably discharges its duties crucial to the survival of plants as well as animals, aerating the soil, breaking down organic material, and feeding generations of birds, toads, turtles, snakes, insects, mice, and other small mammals. And its castings or waste even make a valuable fertilizer. Surely nature would regard the lowly earthworm, unappetizing to our taste and icky in appearance and to the touch, as any child can attest, as beautiful, even sublime in both its form and function. But I am swayed by beauty, seduced by its aesthetic, even though I realize how false, how subjective a value that is. And as the Luna moth finally flew away, the green of its luminous pistachio wings flickering in the veil of the security light, safe for this night at least from the bat's coarse desires, I was relieved. I looked for the Luna moth the next night, and several nights after, but that was the only sighting that summer. But in searching for it on the screens, usurping the cats, whose proper province this was, I gained entry, however glancing, into the secret world of moths, and really saw them for the first time. The moths, supposedly predictable in their plainness, were also creatures of surprise, the reward for my scrutiny. One night, while examining a moth on the screen door, its wingspan some 3 inches, I was startled when it flew off at my touch to see a flash of red. That moth, the sweetheart underwing, has mottled tan-gray forewings, but its hind wings feature a pinkish-orange color. When the moth flies, it reveals that reddish hue, which is meant to disorient predators. Both butterflies and moths have 2 pairs of wings, but butterflies at rest hold their wings vertically over their body, touching, while moths mostly fold their wings flat over each other, so that the forewings obscure part of the hind wings. This variation helps the sweetheart underwing surprise its enemies and escape, and became for me a sort of metaphor for the moth, that its beauty is often hidden, especially the beauty of its adaptations. The virgin tiger moth, also a nightly visitor, its forewings black, veined in yellow, is striking. But it is the moth's deep pink hindwings when exposed that act as a diversion. The moth's bright color is also a signal of its distastefulness, a reminder for birds not to come back for seconds. If I had met the rosy maple moth before the Luna, it might have been the one to attract me, though not as imposing in size. The wingspan at most is about 2 inches. It is a startlingly pretty moth, with its fluffy, vivid yellow body and pink forewings, which also feature a triangular yellow band across the middle. Its bright colors make the moth visible and therefore vulnerable, a seemingly strange adaptation. The conventional wisdom is that these are warning colors, indicating that the moth is distasteful, though several birds, including blue jays, chickadees, and tufted titmice, are known to eat them. Naturalist Jim McCormick sees an additional, slyer purpose for what he calls this colorful camouflage. Rosy maple caterpillars primarily eat maple leaves and as adults are often found in close proximity to these trees. This moth, I noted, looked much as red maple leaves can look in fall, with their variegated color palette, and indeed the red maple is a favorite host. McCormick observes that the moth, when placed among red maple samaras, the helicopter-like fruits of the red maple tree, which are colored pink, green, and yellow, a stage it reaches just as rosy maple moths are hatching, is virtually invisible, providing safe roosts for the rosy maple during the day. As brightly colored as the rosy maple is, the Pandora sphinx moth is cryptic, subdued. When I first saw a Pandora sphinx, I thought it was a dead leaf that had blown onto the window screen. Its patchy, greenish-gray coloration, in hues ranging from olive drab to hunter, is persuasive camouflage, a moth wearing army fatigues. And its elongated, notched wings, which can span 4 inches, reminded me of oak leaves in autumn, curled and dry, which makes it easy for a predator to overlook, mistaking it for litter. Flying at night, many moths wear suits in shades of gray and brown, allowing them to melt into the darkness and evade their enemies. Such somber hues can also help moths retain their body heat, keeping them warm. These discoveries were made at night, but, as I would learn, a good time to moth is during the day. I became aware of moths clinging to door jambs, hiding beneath deck rails, secreting themselves in small, dark spaces, sleeping away the day, a universe of critters I had never noticed. They would only rouse themselves if the sun found them, and then they would fly off to find a new, shady shelter. Their muted colors, I realized, also serve them well in the daylight, helping them blend not only into man-made surfaces, but also on tree bark and branches. But often the moths would hide in plain sight, a vantage out of the glare of the sun, their only criterion for selecting a resting place. Even so, I was stunned when I saw it. A puddle of brown pooling in a corner of the back deck the morning sun had not yet breached. And I felt a frisson of fear. There is something so visceral in our immediate response to strange insects. Anyone who has ever chased a butterfly knows what a futile task that is. Just as you come close, it flutters off and alights on a flower out of reach. Butterflies seem to have a sixth sense about humans, who as adversaries are far less nimble than birds and dragonflies, among the swiftest, most agile of insects. As we bumble along in pursuit, butterflies, ever vigilant, survey us with their 2 large compound eyes, which are composed of hundreds of lenses, each in itself a tiny eye, each seeing an image that, when taken together, makes a mosaic, a virtual wide-angle composite picture of its world. Butterfly eyes are adapted for color vision, to see in bright light so they can spot not only their own species, but also flowers whose nectar they covet. Whereas the compound eyes of moths, which are dark, to absorb as much light as possible, are better suited to see at night. Moths are ineffably drawn to light as well, as it is believed they fly by orienting themselves to the moon and stars, an infatuation that accounts for their passionate embrace of outdoor lighting. Whether confused by artificial light, or perhaps dozing off, deciding it is day, moths are easier to approach, fleeing only the rude curiosity of cats. During daylight hours, they're even more amenable, falling into a deep slumber, which is why a clever hiding place is key to their survival. This particular moth, though hiding in plain sight, was in deep shade, its wings and body wedged partly under 2 deck posts, which made it a difficult target. Its chocolate wings, which spanned over 6 inches, could have been a splash of mud on the deck's deep russet stain. I knew instinctively that it was special and probably rare. And while the Luna would become the anticipated companion of warm June nights, its loping flight and green iridescence, summer's finest gift, This sighting would be the first and only time I would glimpse the Cecropia, the largest moth in North America. Majestic, regal even, are the words that come to mind when gazing at the Cecropia. So it is fitting that its name derives from Cecrops, the legendary king of ancient Athens. On closer inspection of the sleeping Cecropia, I saw that its rich, brown wings had a grayish cast, flecked in white, which gave the moth a frosted appearance. The Cecropia, lying in the shadows on the dark deck, was well disguised. But the moth, tinged in gray, would also blend into rocky surfaces, disappearing into the brackish colors of a Catskill's bluestone boulder. The wings, both forewings and hindwings, were bisected by a rusty red stripe edged in white. The body, I saw, was also red, with white bands, and the areas adjacent to the abdomen were red as well. Red, a warning color in nature, would serve to startle an adversary when the Cecropia took flight. These colors, brown and gray and flashing red, I had observed in other moths, strategies to help them hide and evade their enemies. But the Cecropia also featured prominent dark spots at the tip of each lavender-hued forewing, eye spots or ocelli, an ingenious device of some butterflies and moths to divert a predator's attention away from its body, and that may also aid in mate identification. This explains why we often see Lepidoptera with ragged wings, which, at least in part, can be sacrificed while the body cannot. There were also several smaller dark spots hemming the forewings, more discreet but still diversionary targets. The Cecropia is a big, handsome, brawny moth, without the delicacy and lightness of the Luna in form as well as color, but they do share a striking characteristic. Each has, on both pair of wings, other small eye spots, which are almost transparent. The Cecropias especially are crescent-shaped, windows of red with a whitish center. The ocelli of the Luna's forewings are also crescents, while on the hind wings, circles contain what appear to be quarter moons. For both, these eye spots serve a familiar purpose, to startle predators as the moth makes its escape. But these particular markings also indicate that both moths belong to the same family, the Saturnidae, which gets its name from the fact that several of its members, including the Luna and the Cecropia, feature eye spots that contain concentric rings that are reminiscent of the planet Saturn. The giant silk moths, which the Saturnids include, are the largest moths in North America, as well as some of the most brightly colored. Though some members of the family are relatively small, such as the rosy maple moth. Despite their impressive size, and that in itself may be a deterrent to predators, the Cecropia and the Luna are not dreaded pests. They simply are not abundant enough as caterpillars to defoliate the trees that host them. As is true of all Saturnids, the adults do not eat, drawing sustenance from food stored when the moths were in their larval stage. And they have only vestigial mouthparts, which accounts for their lifespan of only a week or two, spent seeking a mate. That is their sole reason for being, the reproduction of species. Their extraordinary beauty, from our perspective, is a byproduct of nature's adaptive purposes. Even the delicate, feathery feelers that distinguish many moths from butterflies are used to help locate a mate. The female releases pheromones that her suitors, flying in the dark, can catch using their antennae, even several miles away. The Saturnids lack tympana. They do not hear, which is not characteristic of all moths, many of which use their hearing as a defense, a warning of a predator's approach. Which explains why, in succeeding years, I would often spot Lunas at night flying close to the ground, or even resting in the grass. My first response was to rush outside with my flashlight to see if the moth was injured, which it didn't seem to be, stubbornly refusing my well-meaning but misguided urgings for it to fly. The Luna was content to stay there, and I couldn't figure out why. This made the moth, to my conventional, unlepidopterian way of thinking, more defenseless. But, As I would learn, this was also a strategy to counter predators, especially its nemesis, the bat. The Luna can't hear the bat, which squeaks as it hunts, using echolocation, a kind of natural sonar in which bats emit cries, then listen to their echoes, which enable them to locate flying insects. If the Luna isn't flying, the bat, which does not depend on its eyesight to hunt, cannot locate it as readily. Contrary to myth, bats aren't blind, but their sonar gives them an edge in total darkness. My assumptions have been countered once again by nature's common sense, its elegant strategies for survival, seeking balance between predator and prey. Another mystery I pondered is the Luna's coloration, its singular green, certainly unusual in the fashion world of moths, which mostly dress conservatively, depending on bold accents to add color. In its larval stage, this green makes sense. As a caterpillar, the Luna is the same pale green as its parent, the color serving as camouflage as it dines on the tender new leaves of red maple, beech and birch, and black walnut, some of the local trees it favors. As it prepares to pupate, and in the Catskills' chilly climate over winter, after a single generation in June, at least that I have observed, the caterpillar turns brown, falls to the ground, where it wraps itself in a cocoon of its own silk, incorporating a leaf in its disguise, then hides in the litter of the forest floor, where it will emerge as a moth when the weather warms. But what purpose could the adult Luna's shimmering green serve? Wouldn't it expose the moth to danger, flying at night and especially during the day? The answer to the latter question was answered during a June walk, when I almost stepped on a Luna moth, which fluttered up at my approaching footfall. The sleeping Luna, choosing the lush spring grass to nap in, was virtually invisible. The answer to the former question, how does its color serve the Luna at night, is perhaps that it isn't meant to. As I would discover, my sighting of the Luna was an accident caused by my intrusion into the moth's world. The bright, glaring lights that lured away from the enveloping darkness and the relative safety of its vantage, resting or flying low to the ground. The Lunas, and the Saturnids especially, are bedazzled by light. It is a romance that distracts the Luna from mating, and in the case of the female, from laying eggs. The fact that it is so short-lived, surviving about a week as an adult, assuming it evades predation, makes its dawdling even more dangerous. Mad in pursuit of light, Lunas lose time from their task and can even injure themselves, beating their wings against a light source. Ferreting the Luna out of the shadows, light can also make it more vulnerable, especially to the attention of its most faithful admirer, the bat. I turn the security light off once June arrives, leaving only the front door light on, my antidote to the darkness that descends on the mountain, dense with the unknown, full of strange rustling sounds, and even those that I can identify, the yipping of coyotes, seem too close. There is still a risk in this, at least for the Lunas. Opening the front door in early morning, I have found, more often than I would like, two pale green tails lying on the deck, as well as the shattered remnants of green wings. Sometimes that is how I know the Lunas have arrived, by finding one sacrificed in this way. I assume it alights on the screen door and transfixed is an easy target for an enterprising bat, which devours the Luna's luscious body. Its tails, which the bat rejects, are key to the Luna's in-flight defense, a crafty piece of its adaptive puzzle. A long-held belief is that the Luna's long, streaming tails divert attention away from its body, much as eye spots do, though, in the case of the bat, which is not primarily a visual hunter, this would not deter it. Biologist Jesse R. Barber and his colleagues at Boise State University have conducted experiments explaining exactly how this works. The Luna's tails are, in fact, auditory deflectors that confuse the bat's sonar. The spinning hindwing tails of Luna moths lure echolocating bat attacks to these non-essential appendages in over half of bat-moth interactions. In essence, the tails provide an anti-bat strategy designed to divert bat attacks, Barbara posits. Though I am disquieted when I find the remnants of my favorite moth, the Luna, these days I am also comforted, even reassured. It means I have a bat, at least one, still living on the mountain. When I first came to the Catskills in 2002, bats were among the most vibrant constituents of the ecosystem. I would see them at dusk as the weather warmed, pursuing insects overhead, their flight jagged, skittering. My evenings were filled with bats. If I ventured outside at night, they would swoop down, flying low enough for me to hear the rasp of their leathery wings. New York is home to at least 9 bat species. 6, including the most common, are cave bats, which overwinter here. The other 3, tree bats, are migratory. Of the cave bats, the most populous and familiar is the little brown, whose body length is a mere 2 inches, with a wingspan of 8 to 9 inches. It was this bat that popped up behind a shutter as I was power washing the house one warm afternoon. First, a hook-like thumb appeared, then another, followed by a dark brown gremlin's face featuring funnel-shaped ears, a pointed snout, and tiny sharp teeth. The bat looked at me, blinked, a tuft of soap suds topping its fuzzy head. I had awakened this critter, washing it out of its afternoon roost. The bat flew off into the woods, leaving a haven that had been carefully chosen for its western exposure, facing the afternoon sun to keep it warm. I would, as penance, erect a bat box on a nearby tree, painted black to retain heat and facing west, as a summer roost for the little browns, which winter in caves and mines where they hibernate, but seek out the crevices of trees, rocks, and houses too in summer. It was soon tenanted by a small colony of about 10 bats, and I would be spellbound, watching them fly out of it at dusk to hunt, then return at dawn to sleep away the day. Bats are warm-blooded, the only mammals to truly fly, featuring a thumb and 4 fingers on each wing, with a bone structure recalling the human hand, which they use to cling to trees and walls. Still, there is something so primordial about them, as much myth and legend as reality, living shadows of the night. But the bat house has been empty for years now. Starting in 2006, the number of bats in the Catskills began to decline. A mysterious disease, known as white nose syndrome, which has been identified as a fungus, revealing itself as a white residue on the muzzle and wings of afflicted bats, has devastated hibernating bat populations. Nearly 6 million bats have perished since white nose was discovered in an upstate New York cave, perhaps the result of a foreign organism tracked in by cavers. But it is the little browns, my tenants and neighbors, that have suffered the most, losing, by some estimates, 80% of their population. This epidemic, affecting numerous cave bat species, according to the Center for Biological Diversity, is the worst wildlife disease outbreak in North American history, and despite ongoing efforts to find a definitive cause and cure, shows no sign of slowing down. Bats are crucial insectivores, easily the most overlooked, for their economic value to humans, wild critters. It is estimated that one little brown bat can eat up to 600 mosquitoes in an hour. This is a boon to humans, especially in an era of deadly mosquito-borne illnesses, including the West Nile virus and Eastern equine encephalitis. Bats also act as a critical control by gobbling up insects that eat or damage crops. Researchers estimate the value of pest control services provided by bats in the U.S. alone range from a low of $3.7 billion to a high of $53 billion a year. Their loss, if white nose continues to spread, will doubtless have severe and lasting impacts on ecological systems as well as agriculture. Bats also, as insect eaters, save the environment further degradation by lessening the application of pesticides for exactly this purpose. Extinction, as a concept, seems theoretical and remote until you realize with a jolt that the creatures around you are disappearing. The little brown bat is on the verge of extinction in the Catskills and the entire Northeast. The loss of the bats would be like the loss of the night itself. The feeders! I had forgotten to bring them in. The thistle seed feeders were the only ones I hung in summer for the goldfinches, which regurgitate this seed to feed their young. Most other critters, even birds, eschew thistle seed as distasteful. But there was one black bear, a young female, that had taken a liking to it. And having lost too many feeders to her bear brethren, I decided to fetch them, even though it was well after midnight on the mountain. The back porch light was bright, lighting my way. I hadn't found bits of Luna's left by the bats by this light, which was why I had started leaving it on. But heading up the deck steps, I was startled to see a Luna moth caught in a spider web, woven by a clever arachnid to trap insects attracted to the light. I put down the feeders, seeing that the moth was still alive. Delicately, I removed it from the web. Holding the Luna in my hand, I saw strands of the web were stuck to its wings, which I had to remove so that the moth could fly. Drawing a deep breath, anxious that I might tear the delicate wings, I painstakingly peeled off the remnants of the sticky web. The operation was a success, and I opened my fingers so that it could fly. But the Luna stayed in my hand, and I could see every intricate marking so clearly, including the purplish border that edged its forewings, a stunning complement to its iridescent green. The moth seemed content in the glow of the porch light, which spilled over the steps where I was sitting. Perhaps, too, it was comforted by the warmth of my hand. I knew I should shoo it away, go back inside, turn off the light, and let the Luna do its urgent work this warm June evening. But for just a few minutes more, I wanted to sit there with the moth, to feel the lightness of the Luna's being, its weight no more than a breath, to hold beauty in my hand.
That was Chapter 4 from The Quarry Fox and Other Critters of the Wild Catskills, available now at silverhollowaudio.com and wherever audiobooks are found. Cats Cast is a production of Silver Hollow Audio. Please don't forget to subscribe, and we'll see you again in 2 weeks. I'm Brett Barry. Thanks for listening.